I had some fun thinking of the title for this evening's presentation. No birth or death, and no end of birth and death. My practice tradition is Zen, and that's just the kind of paradox we love, right? I mean, Zen is full of them. My title echoes something that's found in the Heart Sutra, which is pretty definitely the most important text, the most important sutra in Zen. Even if you haven't read it, you've likely heard some of it, because it's where that famous phrase, form is emptiness, emptiness is form, it comes from that. But the Heart Sutra also says things like, there's no ignorance and there's no end of ignorance. There's no old age and death, and there's no end of old age and death. And so the question for us this evening is, what can this possibly mean? What sense can we make of it? And I'd like to start approaching that by going back to the Buddha himself, the traditional biographies, which are pretty definitely more mythic than historical, but nonetheless, I think, very wonderful in their own way. According to these biographies, the Buddha was inspired to leave home because he encountered what are sometimes called the three or four heavenly messengers. Right? According to the myths, the Buddha lived in pleasure, surrounded by young people, and he had no awareness of suffering. But then one day his charioteer took him into the town or the village, and for the first time he saw an old man. By the way, notice the sequence, the old man first, and then later he sees someone who's ill, and then finally he sees a corpse, someone who's dead. And on his way back home, after that, he sees the fourth heavenly messenger, that is a renunciate, a monastic, or somebody who has left home on the spiritual path. And his encounter with old age, illness, and death is said to be what makes him realize he can't just enjoy life. He's going to get old. He's going to get sick. He's going to die. And so this is the existential crisis that precipitates him leaving home, going into the forest, and taking this great spiritual path. But here's the interesting thing. Supposedly, again, according to the biography, the Buddha attained his great awakening under the Bodhi tree about the age of 35. And after that, of course, he taught. Thank goodness he did. But he taught for about 45 years, traveling around Northeast India. And so what happened to him? Well, he got old. According to the Pali Canon, he had moments or times of illness, headaches, and according to the Mahaparinibbana Sutra, he had stomach aches, maybe dysentery, that eventually led to his death. So, he left home to solve the problem of old age, illness, and death, and what happened? He got old, he got sick, and he died. So how did he solve the problem? Right? Well, conventionally, right, a lot of religions, especially theistic ones, talk about the solution is something about the soul, that when the moment of death happens, there's a soul that leaves the body, and the soul, unlike the body, is eternal, and so that's somehow some kind of liberation of the soul. But for Buddhism, that doesn't work, because a very important teaching in Buddhism is the idea of no self or no soul, which is really a kind of Greek idea that was introduced into Christianity, that kind of body-soul dualism. The other solution or understanding that some of us might have, which is maybe more compatible with our modern materialistic world is more existential. The idea that the Buddha, well, he accepted his mortality. He became completely comfortable with it. He didn't deny it. And so he simply, as it were, put up with it. In a way, these are kind of two extremes. On the one hand, a kind of a spiritual escape from the material world, escape from the physical body. And the other way, just sort of existentially accepting what's going to happen to all of us. But according to the tradition, that's not what happened to the Buddha, right? According to what Buddhist teachings say, the Buddha, as a result of his awakening under the Bodhi tree, he realized something about his own true nature and the true nature of the world. Something that has been described in many different types of ways, but one of the ways that it can be described is, one of the important ways, is realizing the unborn. That is to say, the Buddha's awakening involved realizing that dimension whereby he couldn't die insofar as he was never born. And this is something that doesn't just apply to the Buddha, it applies to all of us. The point about the Buddha is that he realized his essential nature. We have the same essential nature, that there's something about our nature that is unborn and undying. And again, insofar as we realize the unborn, we can see this perspective whereby we can't die. Now, I know this is sounding difficult. Please bear with me a while here. How can we understand this? What's going on? Well, in Buddhism, there's a lot of emphasis, especially in Mahayana, on what's called the two truths, which maybe are better understood as the two perspectives, the two ways of experiencing. And the basic idea here is that our usual way of experiencing the world, in which we perceive it as a collection of self-existing, real, separate things that are born and die, or that are created and eventually are destroyed, that this is in fact not just the way the world is, but it has to do with seeing the world in a particular way. This is a way that we have learned to see the world. It's a psychological and social construct. And the idea is, if somehow through our practice we can undo this and experience not only the world, but our own essential nature as it is in itself, then we can realize this other dimension where there's no birth and there's no death. This is very important in the whole of the Buddhist tradition. Even in the earliest texts in the Pali Canon, perhaps the two most famous descriptions of nirvana, the goal of the Buddhist path, both talk about the unborn. One of them, in fact, they're both in a section called the Udana. One of them says, "There is, O monks, an unborn, unfabricated," or as I would say, unconstructed. There is an unborn and unfabricated. If there were not an unborn and an unfabricated, then there wouldn't be an escape from the born and the fabricated. But because there is an unborn and a unfabricated, there is an escape from the born and the fabricated. This is the kind of oral tradition. This is the way that they talk. But the important point here is the emphasis on the unborn from the very beginning. And there's other places within the Pali Canon as well that talk about it. This really intrigues me because very often this has been understood to refer to what happens after we die. The way that Buddhism, especially early Buddhism, is conventionally understood, right? There's this idea of karma and rebirth, right? We have karma. Because of our karma, after we die, we're going to be reborn into this world of suffering, craving, and delusion, and it's going to go on and on and on and on. But the Buddha, who's awakened, puts a stop to that. So after he dies, this last time, what's called the parinirvana, he's not going to be reborn. So that's the sense in which the Buddha becomes the unborn. That's the way that it's often been popularly understood. But I wonder if that's a kind of misunderstanding. that the point about the unborn, that the unborn here is a metaphor for something. I've been very struck by something Joseph Campbell said about religious metaphors. Quote, "Half the people in the world think that the metaphors of their religious traditions are facts. And the other half contend they're not facts at all. As a result, we have people who consider themselves believers because they accept the metaphors as facts. And we have others who classify themselves as atheists because they think the religious metaphors are lies." I mean, both are literalist. Whether you literally accept it or literally reject it, maybe you're missing the point about how spiritual language works. Maybe the unborn isn't something describing what happened to the Buddha after his last supposed lifetime, but it's a different way of experiencing the world and ourselves that's possible for us here and now. Again, this is very important in the Buddhist tradition. There's, maybe especially in Mahayana. In the Mahayana tradition, probably the single most important concept of all is shunyata, the term that's usually translated as emptiness. And the synonyms most commonly used to sort of describe emptiness, things that are empty, are unborn, uncreated, and unproduced. The Heart Sutra, which I referred to at the beginning, that also says that things are not created and not annihilated. And Nagarjuna, the greatest of all the Buddhist philosophers, echoes this in the preface to his great book, the Mula Majjhimika Karikas. He prefaces his whole book by saying that things don't die and they're not born. They do not cease to be and they are not eternal. Again, these kind of paradoxes, right? So, again, what I've tried to do so far is just to sort of give you some sense of how important this is in the Buddhist tradition. But does that give us much sense of what's really being pointed at here? It still seems very conceptual, doesn't it? It almost sounds like some kind of philosophical conundrum to solve. But I'm struck that one of the great Zen texts, the Shodoka, or the Qingdao Ke in Chinese, I used to recite this sort of every week in Hawaii when I first started Zen practice. It has this great line: "Since I abruptly realize the unborn, I've had no reason for joy or sorrow at any honor or disgrace." In other words, the unborn is not just some idea, it's actually something we can realize. We can experience the world and ourselves in a different way. And the person in the Zen tradition for whom this is the most important, who made this like the core of his teaching, who talked ceaselessly about realizing the unborn, was a 17th century Japanese Zen master named Bankei, much beloved in Japan. He was a young kid who had, this is so often the biography, right? These deep existential questions that no one could answer. So eventually he left home, became a monk, and he kept looking for somebody to sort of give him the answer to his questions, couldn't find anyone. And finally his abbot said to him, "It's your desire to find someone that keeps you from your goal," right? You're always looking for someone to tell you the answer. So what did he do? He built himself a little hermitage and did zazen, that is to say, Zen meditation. And he really did zazen, right? Nearly continuously, so much so that he had festering sores, it said, on his butt and legs. And about 2 years later, after he started, malnourished and sleep-deprived, he also contracted tuberculosis, which in these days was pretty usually fatal, right? A doctor was summoned but could do nothing, and Bankei prepared to die. At which point, and now I'm going to quote from his memoir or autobiography. I felt a strange sensation in my throat. I spat against a wall. A mass of black phlegm, large as a soapberry, rolled down the side. I haven't been able to figure out how large a soapberry is. Anyway, suddenly, just at that moment, it came to me. I realized what it was that had escaped me since now. All things are perfectly resolved in the unborn. Now, that's his description, but he experienced what he described as the unborn. When you dwell in the unborn itself, he said, you're dwelling at the very wellhead of Buddhas and patriarchs. The unborn is the Buddha mind, and this mind is beyond birth and death. As he later taught, you each received one thing from your mother when you were born, the unborn Buddha mind, nothing else. Rather than try to become a Buddha, when you just stay constantly in the unborn mind, you're a living Buddha in your everyday life at all times. There's not a moment when you're not a Buddha. Since you're always a Buddha, an unborn Buddha, there's no other Buddha in addition that you need to become. Instead of trying to become a Buddha, then, a much easier and shorter way is just to be a Buddha. But again, what does he mean by the unborn? Still, I'm trying to just sort of establish here the importance of this concept. Can we get more of a sense of what it means to say that our true nature, our essential nature, as we often say in Zen, is unborn? And here I want to try to express, to give some sense of that by quoting from the greatest of the Japanese Zen masters, Dogen Keigen, who lived in the 13th century. Starting with what is very likely my all-time favorite Zen quotation, right? Maybe my all-time favorite Buddhist quotation, right? I can't think of anyone I like more right now. And of course, it's paradoxical because it's Zen, right? You ready? Just understand that birth and death is itself nirvana. There's nothing such as birth and death to be avoided. There's nothing such as nirvana to be sought. Only when you realize this are you free from birth and death. Let me say it again. Just understand that birth and death is itself nirvana. So it's not like we're trying to reject this world in order to gain something else. Birth and death, our usual experience, is nirvana. There's nothing such as birth and death to be avoided. There's nothing such as nirvana to be sought. Only when you realize this are you free from birth and death. He says a lot more things about birth and death. Let me just read a few of them, and then I'll try to unpack it a little bit. And this kind of elaborates, or I think kind of tries to clarify the kind of paradox that he just expressed. Right? In birth, he says, there's nothing but birth. And in death, there's nothing but death. Accordingly, when birth comes, face and actualize birth. And when death comes, face and actualize death. Do not avoid them or desire them. Sort of try to cling to them. Birth is an expression, complete this moment. The act of birth, the process of birth, an expression, complete this moment, nothing lacking. Death is an expression, complete this moment. They're like winter and spring. You don't call winter the beginning of spring, nor summer the end of spring. Birth, complete expression of the whole, lacking nothing. Death, complete expression of the whole, lacking nothing. It is a mistake to suppose that birth turns into death. Birth is a phase that is an entire period of itself, with its own past and future. For this reason, in Buddha Dharma, birth is understood as no birth. Death is a phase that is an entire period of itself with its own past and future. For this reason, death is understood as no death. You got that? Let me try to unpack it a little bit as I sort of make sense out of it, okay? Three basic points. Number one, he's saying enlightenment is not other than birth and death. It's not escaping birth and death. It's, you can say, experiencing them in a different kind of non-dual way. So, and this is sort of essential to Mahayana Buddhism, he's not talking about something that transcends this world, but experiencing this world, understanding this world, including ourselves, in a different way. Understanding what's going on in this world in a different way, right? We cannot escape birth and death, yet there is liberation in, or rather as birth and death, if we realize something about their true nature. Secondly, for Dogen, birth and death are not opposites. And this is important because, of course, in daily life they are, right? Birth and death, life and death, they are obviously opposites, especially when you think in terms of life and death. We think that the one excludes the other. We think that, you know, we tend to want life and we don't want death, so we kind of cling to the one and then we kind of push away the horror of death. Even if we know we're going to die, we kind of reject it as long as we can. Dogen says, birth is nothing but birth, death is nothing but death. Face and actualize them. Do not avoid them or desire them. Something about the grasping. Don't grasp at them. And of course, even trying to avoid is a different kind of grasping. Do not grasp at one and try to evade the other. So his solution to this whole thing of life and death, birth and death, is a kind of acceptance, but it's not the kind of typical existential acceptance. Well, it's just going to happen, and we might as well make the best of it. What he's pointing to is when they are not experienced as opposites, when we're not understanding and experiencing the one in opposition to the other, then they don't hinder each other. Then we experience them in a different way. Point three, and this is the big one. This is where it all comes together. When we realize that birth and death are not opposites, then birth is no birth, and death is no death. This is the essential point. As Dogen says elsewhere, in the practice of Buddhism, the idea is to forget yourself, to let go of yourself. And in terms of birth and death, this would mean let go of the sense of a self that is born, or the sense of a self that is experiencing the dying. What happens if we completely become one with the act of birth? Completely, in fact, if you think about it, infants, newborns, that's a funny way of putting it if I'm denying birth, but newborns, right, they don't have a sense of self, right? So at that, for them, there's just this process, just this act of birth. We need to let go of the usual sense of a separate self that is doing the birthing and the dying, and instead completely become the birthing and the dying. When at the time for dying, there is nothing but just the dying, in Japan, tada, just this, neither avoiding it nor seeking it, then death is experienced as no death because there's not the sense of a self that is dying. Again, this goes back to this dualism that I pointed to at the very beginning, where our conventional way of understanding the world, which is a construct, a psychological and social construct, we experience everything, we experience the world, we use concepts and language, we divide it up in terms of these separate self-existing things that then do things. Subjects and predicates. And what Dogen is pointing to here is a different way of experiencing if we're not doing that, if we completely become one with the dying. The same holds true for birth, of course, and birth as no birth is perhaps easier to understand, as I said, because a newborn has no sense of being a discrete self. A discrete being, a subject that's enduring a process. For infants, birth is no birth because there's no sense of self that's being born. But if there's no I, if there's no self that's ever born, then all there is the act or the process of birth. And if there's only the act or process of birthing, then there's really no birth. Because our concept of birth, the way we think about birth, is that there's a self that is born. Our usual way of understanding birth and death is in terms of a self that then has this attribute. It's born at a certain time, and then it dies at a certain time. It's something that happens to the self. What is it? What's the experience then, if there is no self? Instead, the act of birth in itself, and in exactly the same way, death in and of itself, are each an expression complete in the moment, lacking nothing, whole. Mahayana would also emphasize empty, which is another way of making the point that there's not a self that's having this experience. The act of death in itself is an expression complete in the moment, as Dogen says, when not experienced in relation to anything else. Make any sense? I mean, these are tough concepts I appreciate, and that's why I wanted to kind of wrestle with them, because this really goes very deep into the heart of Buddhist teachings and to the heart of Buddhist liberation. You know, the whole point here is that the liberation is, and the Buddha mind and the unborn that Bankei, for example, talks about, it's the experience of the world when there's not a separate self that is having the experience. When, as Dogen urges us to do, when we are able to forget ourselves, let go of ourselves, become one with the experience. And so what we're doing, of course, in talking about the unborn and no death, I'm talking about it primarily in the context of birth and death, because that's what we're especially afraid of. Mm-hmm. Look, we're all going to die, we know that. Truth is, most of us are pretty scared of that. And what Dogen and Bankei are pointing to is a different way of experiencing one's experiences, as it were. So that birth becomes no birth because there's no separate self that's born. And death is no death insofar as there's no self that dies. That when one completely can forget oneself and become the act. Right? Let me try to pull this together in conclusion by asking you all a koan, which is precisely about this. In fact, it's one of the most wonderful Zen koans, I think. And if you can pass the koan, then it means you understand what I've been trying to point to, okay? It's one of Tosotsu's three barriers, right? Three barriers, right? And the second one, he says, when you have realized your true nature, you can free yourself from life and death. How can you free yourself from life and death at the moment of death? How will you free yourself from life and death at the moment of death? That's a great koan, right? Let me say it again. When you've realized your true nature, you can free yourself from life and death. How can you free yourself from life and death when you're at the moment of death? How do you free yourself from life and death at that moment? Anybody? Anybody except Kriti, because I expect she's worked on it in her koan. Yes, Wynn. Well, what does that mean? I mean, those are just the kind of concepts. You know, in the koan, you can't answer a koan by just giving me some ideas. Better. Yes. That's a better concept. Yeah, closer. Yes.
Letting go, not grasping.
Okay, again, we're getting close. We're circling around, but it's still conceptual. In the koan process, you don't talk about this kind of thing. You have to demonstrate. You have to show. Somebody else have their hand up, please. Understanding there is no death. More concepts. More concepts. Sorry?
We have to show it.
Show it. In a way, well, you don't have to die right now, if that's what you mean. But in a way, you do. So, anybody else here want to try? Please.
Surrender?
Great idea. Still concept. In the back? The body that dies. What about the body that dies? It's only, well, that sounds to me a bit close to, you know, it's like in Zen we're not, or in Buddhism, the whole mind, body, soul, body thing, we don't want to go there, right? So we're not sort of devaluing the body because the body dies. Please. Between the in-breath and the out-breath, what? Show me. Anybody? At the moment of death, how will you free yourself from life and death? What did Dogen say? Yeah. I mean, it's a koan, so it's tough. And also, you're probably not familiar with the kind of koan process where, you know, it's not enough just to sort of conceptualize. You have to sort of demonstrate. You have to demonstrate things. So, doesn't sound like it's the moment of death to me. That would work for one or the other of Tosotsu's barriers, but not this one. Yes, ma'am. Simply die. Die in what way? Right? The whole point is to free myself, to free ourselves from life and death, is to free ourselves from the delusion of some self that's going to die. Right? So how can we demonstrate, how can this be demonstrated? Forget yourself in, shall we say, forget yourself in this context. How would you So forgetting yourself in the act, right? Forgetting yourself in the act of what? Right, but in this context, dying, right? Did you want to add to that or say something else? That doesn't work for a koan. Again, it's concepts. It's the idea of an essence. And the danger of that is, again, and this is so deep in so many of our spiritual traditions, the kind of some pure, immortal, eternal, immaterial essence. And that's being distinguished from, you know, the lower body that lusts and smells and dies, and that's not where we want to go here for Buddhism. How will you free yourself at the moment of death? Let me read it once more. I mean, you're all very close. It's just that also learning the kukoans, as Kriti knows, is learning a certain way of demonstrating that's a little unfair, right? So I'm not, but it's fun, right? So, to read it again, when you've realized your true nature, you can free yourself from life and death. How will you free yourself from life and death at the moment of death? Someone spoke about forgetting yourself. Okay, that's, again, letting go of the duality between me and the act of dying, right? Become death or become dying, shall we say? We're talking about a process here, not a noun, not a substance or a thing. Okay, can somebody, I mean, we're all talking around this, can somebody demonstrate it? That is what would be necessary in the room, right? Working on the koan with the teacher, so, right? Kriti? You want to try? Are you ready? Do you remember this one?
No. I'm trying.
Okay. Okay, now, can you tell us what you did? Thank you. Right, right.
My teacher never asked demonstration, so I'm hesitant to explain.
Okay. Right. Well, but concepts are okay once something's been demonstrated. Yeah, okay.
Can you pass me?
yes, but I'd give you a more dramatic version. How can you free yourself from life and death at the moment of death, right? You forget yourself, you let go of yourself, and you become the act of dying. I'm sorry?
Wouldn't that death look the same if you didn't become the dying? The demonstration would be the same.
Yes, but because it's the answer to this particular koan, right? In the room, in the context of the koan study, it's very clear the process is becoming one with it. Losing yourself in the act. Yeah. So
but most deaths
please.
Most deaths aren't like that.
Well, I think more her. That's right.
Version.
That's right.
I mean,
take your pick, right?
The truth of every death.
I'm sorry?
The truth of every death is this.
The breathing stops. Yeah.
Excellent.
Right. Good.
That's
good.
The true demonstration of death.
Good, good. Well, I would prefer, you know, when that happens, you're probably not going to be sitting in the way that you are, but, you know, yeah. So, yeah. I mean, death is basically the end of breathing, isn't it?
Is much demonstration is important, but at the same time, if it's still a concept, we haven't finished the journey. And I guess that's why David was asking me for more. So sometimes I feel hesitant when con work is just contextualized in terms of actions that people do in the room where teacher and student are together, because there is a lot of deep experience of the unborn, which is crucial. I mean, just somehow we can have concept and think some action is necessary and come up with an action. It just doesn't do it to the experience, the true experience of unborn. It's really, there's so much to it.
I mean, and here unborn is another word. I mean, often we say empty. It's the experience is empty. And what you're expressing is what's sometimes called the problem with plastic models, koan, you know, giving that kind of a model. Yeah. This is the second of Tosotsu's three barriers. The first one, you know, how do you realize your essential nature right here and now? So that's the first one. So you have some experience of emptiness of the unborn. And then he asks in the context of, okay, at the moment of your death, what difference will that make? How will you free yourself at the moment of death? Yeah. I'm sorry, did I interrupt you, Kriti?
Yeah.
I mean,
So there is a lot more to embody, experience, and really be with before you can go into the demonstration koans, so to speak.
So I've taken that out of context, and I created a new context, you know, focusing on the unborn and the undying, with emphasis on the point that from the perspective of which that in addition to our usual way of experiencing the world and ourselves, what's called the relative truth, the conventional truth, in which things are created and annihilated, people are born and die, that there's this other dimension that we're normally not aware of. And this is the dimension of the unborn, such as Bankei and Dogen talk about. The unborn, and insofar as we're unborn, there's nothing to die, yeah. So that's the paradox, the two sides. On the one hand, there is the unborn, no birth, no death. But of course, from the other side too, from the relative and the conventional, there is no end of birth and death. For me, when I sort of turn to my Buddhist philosophy, And I'm aware of the dangers with this, but it really does help to make the point that our whole normal understanding of birth and death is relative to the sense of self that is born and that does die. And if that sense of self is seen through, if we're able to forget ourselves and let go of it, then we experience, you know, not only the dying, but to everything. But everything we do in a different, more non-dual, or as Buddhism says, you know, they're all empty, empty of a sense of self that's experiencing them. Please.
Is there a word in Japanese for self?
Yes, there are several words. They don't, you know, Japanese is not an Indo-European language. It's more influenced by Chinese. And they don't, in many cases where we would have to say I, in many cases that is not said. It's just kind of understood. Or we would understand the I is there. But the Japanese is much more just the process. Mm-hmm. Much more the... So, for example, you ask me, if you ask me, do I understand? And Japanese response, wakata. Now, in English, we would say, I understand. But in Japanese, it's simply understood. You know, and that's very, very common. In most cases, Japanese avoids words like watashi or boku for the I. So it's quite striking. So it is much more of a kind of process-oriented language. Yeah.
Yeah, I asked that question because I don't speak Japanese. And in Spanish, which I do speak some, there's the word ser to be.
Hmm.
You can't say it. It's not the same as English saying myself.
Hmm.
If I say mi propio ser.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know enough about Spanish.
It's like saying my own to be.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, see, and
there's a lot of word stuff going on here.
Yeah. And see, Spanish is Indo-European. And I mention that because, again, it's with language that the world is constructed and the sense of self as part of the world is constructed. And Indo-European languages, they all tend to distinguish the subject, the thing, from the predicate, or, you know, what the thing does. And so we learn to see the world in that way. As I said earlier, we tend to see the world as separate things that engage in, and then do something. And so that's essential to the construction, and therefore letting go of language, as happens when we're meditating, is essential for undoing that construction and coming to experience the world, including oneself, in a different way. Yeah. Please, Win.
Yes.
Last question. Yeah.
Thank you. So I have something that David Chernikov said 1 week, and I asked him to write down for me, and it was Zen saying, those who die before they truly die are free to really live. And I like that.
Well, I mean, in a way, Kensho or Satori in Zen is sometimes called the great death. It's the death of the ego. I mean, I love the great myth, as I understand it, of Buddhism, right? The four heavenly messengers, the existential old age, illness, and death. The only other myth that seems to me as profound and meaningful is the myth of death and resurrection. But especially if we understand it, I think, metaphorically. It's not that Jesus, for example, dies and is resurrected for us, but rather it's something that we have to undergo on the path. We have to, you know, I haven't said very much about it in talking about this, but it's assumed that in order to really let go of the sense of self, it's very often a kind of painful sense of death. And then there's a kind of liberation. We realize this true nature. Yeah.
But who lets go?
Sorry? Good question.
No, I'm serious.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Yeah. As soon as we talk about this kind of stuff, we get caught up in circles. Anyway, does it make sense? Did some of this communicate? Yeah. Thanks very much for your attention.